The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
Okay. So this is class 24. We didn't quite finish with class 23 on genetic influences. Of course, we've been talking about genetic influences a lot in this class, but the questions were about it were more specific in this class, and we ended after posing this question, but we didn't really deal with it, if I remember. I want you to know some examples from artificial selection experiments. They actually wouldn't have to be experiments that show strong genetic influences on behavior. If you think of things that weren't experiments, but where breeding was done, you know any examples where breeding has been done for particular behaviors in animals? What are you thinking of?
Horses or dogs?
Yeah, horses and dogs both. They'll breed horses for speed, for example. They'll breed dogs for herding ability. And for, of course, some of this arose, I think they don't know where it came from, because they don't know the full history of all the breeds. But in many cases, dogs are bred for looks, and that certainly works, but it also works breeding them for behavior. You know, the dachshund was bred both for having short legs so it could crawl into a badger burrow and get them out, but also had to be willing to attack the badger, or at least expose the badger so the hunter could grab it. But what about selective breeding in modern times? And I mention here that it's been done with crickets, an example in the book. So we can breed crickets that will sing more than the others or sing less than the others. And it doesn't take too many generations before you can get different strains that will behave differently. So what does that mean? That means there had to be variation in the initial population. That's always a key, talking about evolution. That's really one of the basic requirements for evolution to occur. And we come back to that minute when that fails. It's been done a lot with fruit flies, because fruit flies have such a short generation time, short lives. You can breed differences in behavior more quickly. What's the most well-known, the famous behavioral differences created in fruit flies by someone in this department, Chip Quinn? Does anybody know? He bred flies that were different in their learning abilities. You know, he bred one called Dunce, for example, one called Rutabaga. He named them after vegetables to indicate how stupid they were. He bred them for not being able to learn, but of course he had to breed ones that could learn too. He was able to separate them by a screening procedure where he tested their learning ability, their ability to condition and solve simple problems. That has been done with rats. In the rat experiments, the problem always here is the amount of time it takes to screen, but rats are very good at learning mazes. So they were able to breed a maze smart and a maze dumb strain of rats. The ones that were very good at solving mazes, the ones were less good. So again, it depended on variation. In any population of rats, presuming that they're not too inbred in the first place, you can get rid of a lot of variability by inbreeding. It's another problem with inbreeding we were talking about last time. Remember, we were computing the coefficient, the inbreeding coefficient, which is the same as the coefficient of kinship. It's been done, of course, with mice. And now, of course, it's not so much selective breeding people are doing. They're going and actually altering the genome, you know, creating genetically different animals by knocking out certain genes or knocking in certain genes by inserting them in the egg. But how do we study such things in humans? We don't consciously do selective breeding. People do that voluntarily by who they choose to marry, and whatever. But what are the studies? They're the twin studies. So what is the logic of a twin study? Can somebody describe the logic of a twin study? Yeah.
You have two people with the same genes, they can raise in different environments and see.
Okay, if they've got the same genes, then you know genetically they should be identical. Are genetic twins always identical? They're never completely identical, are they? Because the environments in which they grow from the womb onward is usually a little different. Okay, but they can be remarkably similar. Okay, and that means not just their external appearance, but their brains are also remarkably similar. We can assume that. So any differences then should be due, the major differences are due to environmental effects. So this, in the standard paradigm, you look at a trait like frequency of schizophrenia or intelligence, performance on some intelligence test or whatever you want to study, and you look at it in twins reared apart or together. People are most interested in finding twins that were reared apart, so they grew up in different environments. And then they compare them. For example, one way to do it is to compare them with paternal twins. They're not genetically identical, but were born at the same time. That were also reared either together or apart. You want to find out. You match them in that way, and then you find out if they're genetically identical. What do they find with such studies when you do such comparisons? Comparing the genetically identical people and the ones that are not genetically identical, but were reared either differently or the same. Of course, when we say they're reared the same, we're making big assumptions about birth order and age of siblings and things like that. So, but you can try to control for a lot of those things. You get things that surprised a lot of Americans, especially because of so many assumptions being made about the effect of rearing. If you look at intelligence test performance, for example, you find that there are greater differences early in life, but later the genetically identical ones are much closer than the ones that are not. You can work out, they call it the concordance rate, you can work out for schizophrenics, for example, that you find out that genes are not the only factor. But if you have a person who becomes schizophrenic and he has an identical twin, that twin will have about a 2/3 chance of eventually being diagnosed as schizophrenic also. And it will surprise you to know that the same concordance is true for diabetes, the kind I have. So it's not totally genetic. And people wonder about that, but now I think we have more of an explanation. What you inherit in the case of diabetes is a failure to respond the same way to certain viruses. And so the virus will trigger the immune system in a certain way, and the immune system then cannot recognize in a person with diabetes these cells in the pancreas as being self, because they lack a certain protein on the surface. So the result is your own immune system destroys these cells. So it's an autoimmune disease. But again, if your immune system is never triggered by a virus that causes certain antibodies to form, then you'll never get this form of diabetes. That's probably accounts for why the concordance is not 100%. Now, is such a thing true of schizophrenia? We don't really know. Probably not, but it could be something else. But not everybody with an identical twin that's schizophrenic becomes schizophrenic. So there are definitely a number of behavioral things that also affect social behavior that have a strong genetic component anyway. And that's what we find out from the twin studies. Okay, now there were some interesting discussion questions for chapter 3 I wanted you to look at. I'll only comment a little bit about these. The first one, you have your book. I told you, always bring your book. It's not too heavy to carry. It's a small book. Bring your book. Because I don't have the energy to copy all these questions out. Okay? I know I should just scan them. But my scanner is still not working since I moved it to the new lab upstairs here. Okay? So he says, one sometimes reads that sociobiologists are attempting to make... I was going to give you this as a homework, so you have to pick one of these and do it. But you're supposed to give me something today, right? Could you pass them in here so I can... Or I'll forget.
Okay. You want one copy or two?
Well, I asked for two topics. Okay. But I only need one... paper. If you don't have it, send it to me attached to email, okay? Okay. Just stack them up right here. And I'll go through them and I'll try to send you some feedback about it. Okay. One sometimes reads that sociobiologists are attempting to make the case that certain differences between individuals or races are genetic in origin. Thus, the supposed goal of the sociobiologist is to establish that the criminal differs hereditarily from the non-criminal, or that the average IQ score differs among racial groups because of genetic differences between individuals or populations. How would a sociobiologist respond to this claim? Anybody think about that?
I'm just thinking you'd have to, because it's just the genes and the cousins, you also have to look at environmental.
First of all, remember the difference between proximate mechanisms and ultimate. The sociobiologist is interested in ultimate mechanisms, okay? He would ask about difference in evolution. Why did racial differences appear at all? And does the difference, would there be differences in behavior? That might affect performance on an intelligence test. You're not dealing there with proximate mechanisms. And I can say a lot more about that. Because people make huge mistakes and they're thinking about this. And it's very difficult when you're dealing with groups as large as races to present any kind of coherent argument about such differences. But that doesn't mean you can't study it. You can. It's easy to get that kind of data now. And what I can say about it is that, first of all, the variation within the group is very large in all the different races, much greater than any difference in the mean. Okay. the tiny differences in the means that exist may not mean very much because of the variation, cultural biases built into intelligence testing. Even from one test to the other, you could get differences depending on how they're constructed. In other words, the differences are small. There are differences in brain size. Again, it's the same. A lot of variations in brain size. You know, male brains are much larger than females, but even in general, it's a correlation of body size. But again, the variation within the race or between criminals and non-criminals, the variation within those groups is very great. There are certain genetic differences that seem to correlate with increased probability of criminal behavior. The XYY syndrome, for example, the genetic anomalies that seem to increase maleness, that lead to increased probability of the kind of problems that lead to criminal behavior. There are many factors that affect brain size. Some of you have heard me talk about this if you had my neuroanatomy class, that have nothing to do really with intelligence, but they might have to deal with sensory capacity. Like Australian Aborigines have somewhat larger parietal areas, and they have incredible spatial abilities that exceeds the spatial abilities of most Europeans anyway. So there are at least some small differences have been found, at least claimed. I'm not sure enough brains have been studied. Now that we have imaging capabilities, things like that will be easier to do. What I've seen has all been based just on autopsy material that's been collected. I don't know the imaging studies. Okay. But in general, it's not the main aim of the sociobiologist is not to present a genetic deterministic view of such populations, though he is interested in how they evolve and whether there's any behavioral component to it. Let's talk about the second question. Instincts are sometimes said to be more strongly controlled by genes than is learned behavior. Do you agree or disagree, and why? In your answer, discuss your view of how genes influence the development of physiological systems necessary for activating an instinct or controlling a learned behavior, etc. So are instincts more determined by genes? Yes.
To me, it seems obvious. I mean, instincts aren't learned behavior. They're instinctual. They're innate. So they'd be more controlled by genes than learned behavior.
But to say they're more controlled, you see, that's sort of loaded. If you mean by more controlled by genes that there's more similarity from one individual to the next, then yes. That's why we call them fixed action patterns, because of something fixed in the genes, and because of so if a whole group of animals has the same genes, you're going to keep getting that kind of behavior. You're still going to get variation depending on rearing. But what about learning? Learning does not happen in a vacuum. You cannot learn without the genes that determine those processes in the brain that are responsible for learning. If you don't have plastic synapses in certain parts of the brain, you can't learn. And those plastic synapses depend on your genetics. You know, the whole brain structures that control behavior developed because of the genetic control of developmental processes. That's the proximate cause, and that's what developmental neurobiology is about. Okay. Another thing to keep in mind is that behaviors don't depend on a single gene. And you talk about, somebody says we have a gene for a certain behavior. It's a little bit ridiculous on the face of it, because behavior is so complex, it never depends on one gene. But that doesn't mean that one gene can't influence behavior. Because it can, and that's, some of the gene knockout studies have certainly shown that. But exactly how it controls a behavior, you're not going to learn readily from a gene knockout study. Because if you knock out a gene, it might affect the brain in many different ways. Okay? And one of the influences will be to affect certain kinds of behavior. A gene can have pleiotropic effects, many different effects, especially if it acts early in development. So there's no real simple answer, but if you mean that genes, we think of genetic control as something rigid. See, that's the implication here. But the best answer would say that both kinds of behavior do depend on genetics. But the degree of similarity across people will vary less for fixed action patterns, much less than for learning, like you said at the beginning. Okay, the third one. I would say let's not deal very much with the third one. It's rather complex, and the answer, just from my standpoint, studying biological determinants of behavior, it would require a pretty complex answer. But in general, they're switching causing one gene. They're inserting one gene, okay? And they're producing animals that are more likely to be monogamous, with a stronger attachment to the mate. But notice they said that doesn't happen unless they give them vasopressin. So right away you have to ask, well, wait a minute. They're giving vasopressin. Maybe, what about the controls? They didn't mention that. Maybe vasopressin alone can do it. In fact, it can, in the studies I've seen.
Is the gene they're inserting something that promotes the development of vasopressin?
Well, that's a question. We'd have to find out what he's... He may have made a mistake when he wrote this. I was wondering about that, because...
Is there a gene that increased the expression of vasopressin receptors?
Sorry?
They inserted a gene that increased the expression of vasopressin receptors.
Okay. But still... If it's vasopressin that determines the behavior normally, why did they have to inject extra vasopressin? You should get the same effect, more vasopressin.
The same effect with extra vasopressin is to increase sensitivity to normal levels of vasopressin by increasing the number of receptors.
Right. So you might need to do both to get a large difference in behavior, right? But in general, a single gene can influence behavior, but it doesn't determine the behavior. It's a complex thing. It requires many genes. But yes, you can influence behavior with one gene. But it would be improper to say that's a gene for monogamous behavior.
What about instinct? So, I remember in previous lectures you said that instinct can be learned also in the parental care, or we can learn to better the execution of our instinct. But is the learning always adaptive? Is the learning to execute the instinct, is it always self? Is it always...
No. The gene, the infant's environment can be adaptive or maladaptive in terms of, if you're speaking in terms of genetic fitness, defining adaptive the way we've been defining it here. We all know stories about learning the wrong things from parents and the guilty mother who feels she's ruined her children's life, or the daughter that blames her mother for everything bad that hails from her happens to her. None of them are, of course, quite true. But no, learning can go in either way. It depends on the environment. But we can be pretty sure that the majority of genetic differences, sorry, the majority of the genetic influences were adaptive, or they wouldn't have evolved. Okay. And the fact that learning can influence it must have been adaptive. If it's not, a behavior's not totally fixed in the gene. Okay. But that doesn't mean that it can't go awry. Something bad can happen. But the probability of that happening must be lower, because if the number of maladaptive learning cases were greater than the number of good learning cases, then the gene would be lost. Okay. Now he has a couple chapters defending sociobiology as science. He's really talking about how scientific method is used in sociobiologic research. That it's not just about telling stories about how this may have evolved. But my first question concerns what could cause a non-adaptive change in the evolution of social behavior, because the people that attack sociobiology put a big emphasis on this. They claim sociobiologists paid no attention to non-adaptive reasons for genetic changes that could affect social behavior. And I saw two major things he pointed out. One is a phenomenon they call genetic drift. Especially in smaller populations, you get genetic changes will, of course, occur spontaneously. You get mutations, and you can get a mutation that's preserved even if it's not adaptive. If you have a small population, just by chance, you might lose a normal, the more adaptive gene. And that one of the hypotheses about why the immune system of the cheetah is so limited is that it went through a period of low population number. And because of genetic drift, these genetic changes that couldn't work out, and maladaptive ones get weaned out, adaptive ones preserved in evolution, you had some genes for immune system that were lost. But he also points out that that's only one hypothesis. There may have been adaptive reasons why that happened to the cheetah that haven't been adequately studied. It's not easy to think of such things, but at least he wanted to leave open that possibility. We mention another thing that could cause maladaptive social behavior. He talked about pet love in humans. We say it's maladaptive in the sense that it seems to be benefiting another species. And if you, one hypothesis was that it's a byproduct of socialization processes that happen to enhance our emotional relationship with other people, but then it's because of the way puppies look and so forth, their infantile faces when they're young and so forth, we can become very attached to them just the same way as we become attached to our own children. Yes?
Makes sense to me, because didn't the evolution of the relationship between like people and dogs, didn't it begin as people with wolves? Or was there some point when it was just puppies?
Well, we assume that it actually, when I've read about this, people have different opinions about how far back it goes, but you do see evidence of dogs associated with humans very, very far back, before there's any written records, and so there are other hypotheses besides the one we just mentioned, adaptive reasons why, because dogs were so useful for hunting and so forth, and he pointed out the maladaptive things, they cause diseases, their bites can get infected, if you don't have good antibiotics, you might die, you know, things, these are all costs of having pets, okay, and that all might be the result of this byproduct of the way we respond to these very social animals and their attachment to us. I think the more likely one is their role in hunting, because in fact people use dogs that they don't get very attached to in an emotional way. My father kept dogs for hunting, and he kept us away from them because in fact they were not very nice to children, especially small children. You can easily get bowled over by them and might even be harmed. So he kept us away from them. And yet they were highly trained for usefulness in hunting. And I used to watch my father, who was a hunter, and how incredibly useful that dog was. He could never be able to catch the birds he caught without the dog. Because the dog could detect the bird that he could not see. He would see him in the grass. The dog could smell, maybe also hear him, but mostly smell the grass. And as soon as the bird would be detected by the dog would freeze. His tail would point straight out and his nose would point right towards the bird. My father would get ready and he would give a little signal to the dog. The dog would flush the bird. And then the horrible things would happen, hunters do. I never became a hunter. I like to hunt birds to study. Anyway, that's how things we know about how non-adaptive change could affect social behavior. And he points out, Alcock points out, that sociobiologists are quite aware of these things, but in fact most behavior we think is due to adaptive evolution. He spends a lot of space on this little preliminary report on mountain bluebirds by David Barish. It appeared in 1976. It was a scientific note in American Naturalist, and his experiment included observations of just a few bluebirds. Not really a substantial scientific study, but it was not written as one. It was written as a preliminary report, a short note to other scientists to point out something interesting. Gould attacked it rather viciously, called it a just-so story that was made up. Let's see if I can find the quote here. Gould claims that Barish had produced a just-so story, an untested and untestable fable. And that's commonly the kind of phrases you see used against sociobiology. Untested, untestable. What they were really upset about is things that were said about human evolution where you couldn't directly observe. Because we can't go back in the past and observe whether the conditions that they were necessary, the evolution happened. We can't test it in a very easy way. But it was really not a fair argument at all, because it was a preliminary report. The hypothesis was, in fact, eminently testable by various means. Barish simply claimed that if he was observing a mountain bluebird pair, a mating pair, and he put, I think he used stuffed bluebirds, males, models, in the territory, that male. The male would attack those models, spend time attacking them, and he would also increase his attacks on his mate. Another thing that was observed, I think he observed it only once, is that the male would start copulating more with his mate. But what was interesting there isn't that it was all true, but that it was a testable hypothesis. It was a real hypothesis about why he explained why he thought this was adaptive behavior. Okay? So he did not, he was trying to reduce the chances that his mate would have her eggs fertilized by another male and he would spend his time rearing another male's progeny. The interesting thing about that little paper was what it led to, because much later, these so-called extra pair copulations that we talked about before were studied more and more. The bluebirds were studied with larger studies, and it turned out that the Barash claims were only partially supported. The part about him attacking his own mate and so forth, perhaps to drive her out and attract another mate, weren't really true. He didn't attack her any more than before, and she often attacked him also. Wasn't so affected by the models. But part of it was supported. They do attack the intruding males. It just turns out they don't necessarily do it just at the breeding time. But one thing they do at the breeding time, and this was found later, is if they see their mate, their female, in near another male, they will copulate with her more frequently, which is what the sociobiological hypotheses would predict. So in general, it led to a much increased interest in these extra pair copulations, which was not really much known at all before then. Most of the studies have been done in birds. And he points out that between 95 and 99, just those few years, there were 498 articles on those topics. So now we have a lot more facts about that behavior and its variations, when it occurs, when it doesn't occur. So the reason he spends so much time is just because of Gould's attack. So he comes to Barash's defense, points out the great usefulness of the article, even though it wasn't totally correct. It was still a new scientific method. Okay. And Barash himself was fully aware of the limitations of the study. Okay, now about comparative methods. There are various ways to test hypotheses about what's adaptive in social behavior. And one way is to compare different species. The basis of this method is that if animals are faced with sufficiently similar selective factors, and they have a similar social organization, then they should evolve the same type of adaptive behaviors. Now that's a pretty big demand, because we're dealing with species that comparative method is not always done in very closely related animals. You don't have to look at other species of bluebird, okay, to use the comparative method to test those hypotheses we were just talking about. You could pick other kinds of birds, and in some cases you can even pick animals that aren't birds, but you see a lot of similarities in social organization and the situations they face, and you'd predict that they might do the same thing. So for example, this tendency to copulate with the mate when you see her in the vicinity of another male, or perhaps even see her engaged in extra pair copulations, they found that in a couple of finch. Now this was at the time he wrote here, just a few years ago, two finch species, two shorebirds, two species of hawk, one other bird, a shrike, and also in bighorn sheep, where they've observed that same phenomenon. Okay. So again, that's support for the basic hypothesis of the adaptiveness of that kind of behavior, why it has evolved. Because it's evolved multiple times, in you call that convergent evolution. Okay, it doesn't mean they had common ancestors, but it means when faced with the same situation and they had a similar social organization to begin with, then it's likely they would develop the same adaptive behavior over evolutionary time. Okay, and then he deals a little bit with Robert Ardrey, because Ardrey's book, The Territorial Imperative, occurred very early. It was written in 1966. Sometimes used as an example of bad sociobiology. It was actually before sociobiology arose as a specific term used. That was 9 years before the publication of E.O. Wilson's book. But I remember reading it as a young person studying science, The Territorial Imperative. And I can remember he described territoriality in many different animals. He said it was so common that humans must have the same kind of territorial instincts, and it could account for the what reasons we have strict borders, why we own property, why we fight with each other over territory, why we have wars over territory, and so forth. Imperative, he meant instinctive behavior. Okay, the problem is it's far from universal in animals. Ardrey would have had to find it just about in every animal. Okay? They're not even working on it. They have a piece of the ceiling out there. Okay. Sorry about that noise. So it's not universal in animals. And even if you just look at territorial practices in humans, you find tremendous variation, a lot of variation from culture to culture and so forth. And he also points out that most trained biologists interested in using evolution, their own study, evolutionary thinking in their studies, never took Ardrey very seriously. Okay. But it did make a large, it was a popular book, and it made a big popular impact. But it is not to be confused with sociobiology. Books like the later one by Morris called The Naked Ape were similarly very popular, but they include a lot of just-so stories and a lot of wild speculations, some of which may be true, some of which are probably completely fantasy. Okay, and you don't find that kind of thing in serious sociobiological papers. And as you probably know by now, most sociobiological papers, papers that we would classify as sociobiology, are not on humans at all. Okay, but there is a group of people interested in human sociobiology and human ethology as well, which would include non-social behaviors. Okay, I was interested in this one statement that occurs in Alcock's book. He says, humans and chimps are the only species among the 4,000 species of mammals in which male relatives form groups to raid other groups while living in and defending the area of their birth. In other words, they have wars, intraspecific wars. I'm just asking you, if you were going to look for exceptions to that claim, where would you look? See, I'm not convinced that it's true. I mean, we used to think that humans were the only ones that did that. In fact, we used to think that humans were the only ones that ever killed without having any reason to kill for food. But in fact, there are animals that kill. They kill in territorial fights. Animals will, cats, for example, if they're deprived of hunting, but not deprived of food, so they have plenty to eat, but they're deprived of hunting, they will kill. If they're deprived of exercising that instinct for a long period of time, they will kill. And then not eat the food. They'll play with a mouse that they've injured and just play with it and play with it. They're just exercising their instincts. Okay? And occasionally they will actually kill them as well. That's a little different from this. You're looking at this actually forming of groups of males related to each other and going off to attack other groups. What other animals do you think might do that? I would like to see studies of, for example, dolphins to find out if you ever have that, because they live in groups too, are often related to each other. Dolphins will stay near their mother for long periods of time. Okay, they're very social. There are groups of whales, similarly, and orcas, killer whales. I would look in those groups to find out. I don't think we have enough studies to know. But what about other primates? Would you look at orangutans? They're very highly developed primates, very smart, close to chimpanzees in essence. But you'd be much less likely because they don't have the same social organization, okay? They're lone foragers, come together for mating, okay? They don't have that group behavior that chimpanzees have or the humans have. What about gorillas? They do live in groups, and they are close related. There are many differences also with chimps, but the field studies of gorillas that have been done don't show this kind of, they have not found that kind of behavior. Okay. But I just wanted to point out that maybe it's a little too soon to make this kind of claim, that I don't think enough detail is known about. After all, chimpanzees had been studied for quite a while by Jane Goodall and her groups of students that were over there at Gombe Stream Reserve in Africa before the students came across this phenomenon, which was very surprising to them when they discovered it. So I think we probably don't know yet.